From NPR News, this is Weekends and All Things Considered. I'm Guy Raz. Earlier this summer, here in Washington, a few top CEOs came to testify at a hearing of the Senate Finance Committee.
Gentlemen, you probably know the rules.
These were the heads of multi-billion dollar companies. Thomas Falk from Kimberly-Clark, they make everything from Kleenex to Huggies. Larry Merlo, the CEO of CVS, was there, and so was Michael Duke.
The president and CEO of Walmart Stores, the world's largest retailer, an employer of about 2.1 million people.
And all these CEOs came with one message. Corporate taxes are too high.
My advice is straightforward.
Walmart CEO Mike Duke.
Lower the corporate rate as much as you can and move to a territorial system.
Our cover story today, corporate taxes. You hear it all the time, not just from CEOs, but politicians.
The United States has the second highest corporate tax rate in the world.
Our taxes are higher than any other nation besides Japan.
We cut that corporate rate to zero.
We've got to bring our tax rate down.
We've got to bring that tax rate down.
I will do that on day one.
That was Mitt Romney speaking in Nevada this week, and earlier Michelle Bachmann, Rick Santorum, and Rick Perry, all, of course, vying for the Republican presidential nomination. And then, just the other day, in a speech to Congress, President Obama said basically the same thing.
By eliminating pages of loopholes and deductions, we can lower one of the highest corporate tax rates in the world.
And on paper, it's true. The corporate tax rate here in America is 35%, one of the highest rates in the industrialized world. And a few companies, like Walmart, do actually pay something close to that. But for a variety of reasons, many, many others pay a lot less. Take, for example, a company now valued as America's sixth richest.
If Google paid taxes at the full 35% rate on all of its profits, it would lose almost a quarter of its total profits.
That's Bloomberg investigative reporter Jesse Drucker, and you heard him correctly. If Google paid the full U.S. corporate tax rate, it would lose about a quarter of its earnings.
And so it really gives you a sense of the degree to which the tax planning and tax departments in these companies are crucial to the bottom line of some of these companies.
Like GE's accounting department, which employs dozens of former officials from the Treasury Department and the IRS. Google's tax department is also really good at figuring out ways to save on taxes. So good that instead of paying a 35% corporate tax rate, Google pays just 2.4% on profits it moves offshore. And it's all above board, all perfectly legal. So how does it work? Well, with a plan set in motion back in 2003, when Google transferred all of its non-U.S. intellectual property rights to a company branch in Ireland.
In other words, from that point forward, any profits coming from sales overseas would get attributed not to the U.S. parent, where they would get taxed at a rate of 35%, but they would get attributed to the Irish subsidiary. And in Ireland, the corporate income tax rate is 12.5%.
So from 35% to 12.5%. That's pretty good, right?
But Google didn't really stop there. In other words, they weren't satisfied to just have their profits overseas taxed at a rate of 12.5%.
So the company used a technique known in the world of corporate accounting as the double Irish. The Google branch in Ireland
pays royalties to a second Irish subsidiary, this one that declares its tax residence in Bermuda. This is why it's called the double Irish. You have one Irish sub making payments to a second Irish sub, and the second one is headquartered in a place like Bermuda where there's no corporate income tax.
No corporate income tax at all. But there was one more hurdle to leap. To move its money to Bermuda, Google would have to pay Irish taxes to transfer money out of Ireland.
So they first have to go to a Dutch subsidiary in between.
That technique has a name too, the Dutch sandwich.
This is where the Dutch sandwich nickname comes from. So the payments go from the Irish sub to the Dutch sub to the Bermuda resident Irish sub. And the combination of these strategies has helped Google cut its effective tax rate overseas to the low single-digit rates. And this is the combination of the two strategies, the double Irish and the Dutch sandwich.
Could you call it a stroopwafel? It's enough to make your head spin, but for Google, all that crafty accounting added up to $3.1 billion over 3 years, more than half of the entire GDP of Bermuda, where that money is being protected. And Jesse Drucker says a lot of other American companies do the same thing, specifically tech companies.
So why do these companies like Google and Apple and Microsoft and Cisco pay such low corporate income taxes, but then a company like Walmart, they actually pay close to 35% of the rate? I mean, it doesn't seem fair.
Yeah, I mean, well, Walmart has used various strategies at the state level that have actually been challenged in a number of states. But yeah, I mean, Walmart has a harder time of it because, you know, it's a store selling things. It's much harder to say that the profits are the result of intellectual property that resides with an Irish subsidiary.
But you're saying even if we were to reduce the corporate tax rate in this country to 20%, it might not necessarily change anything.
Well, obviously, no one can predict the future, but here's what we know. We know that the corporate income tax rate in a number of countries overseas, even in our competitors, you know, in the G7 countries, is in the mid to high 20% range. U.S. companies are not shifting income into those countries. They are not shifting income into the U.K. and France and Italy. They are shifting income into Bermuda and the Cayman Islands, where there is no corporate income tax at all. And if that's the case, it seems to me that it raises questions about whether cutting the U.S. corporate income tax rate would do anything to change any of this behavior.
Now, keep in mind, everything Jesse Drucker's been talking about only applies to the profits companies shift overseas. But when it comes to paying corporate taxes in the U.S., well, consumer advocate Ralph Nader says the situation isn't much better, in large part because of all the loopholes and tax credits.
The latest report by Citizens for Tax Justice listed 12 major corporations. We all know them: General Electric, American Electric Power, DuPont, Verizon, Boeing, Wells Fargo, Honeywell International, IBM, Yahoo, United Technologies, ExxonMobil, and FedEx. In the last 3 years, these corporations made a total of $171 billion in U.S. profits, paid zero federal income tax, and got $2.5 billion back. That's the story.
Now, you've been talking about this for a long time, and you mentioned that compared to the 1950s, I believe corporate taxes accounted for about 30% of government revenue. Today, it's about 9%, maybe 8.5%, not entirely clear, but
Yes. Clearly
much lower today than it was in the 50s, for example. Was there a time when corporations, sort of felt like it was their duty to pay higher taxes?
Well, I think they were more rooted in the community. Now they're global corporations, and they had a reduced allegiance to our country and to our communities, other than to control them. And this is a seismic change in what might be called any semblance of U.S. corporate patriotism.
You could argue, Ralph Nader, that corporations provide products and services that improve the lives of, you know, lots of people. I mean, I can go to Walmart and buy affordable groceries, for example. You can get an affordable dishwasher or appliance that's made by General Electric. We all have more access to information because of Google. All of these companies pay different corporate taxes, but I'm wondering if in some cases the good outweighs the bad.
I don't think it does. I think increasingly the necessities of life are being denied the American people. After all, Harvard researchers say 45,000 Americans die every year because they can't afford health insurance to get diagnosed and treated. Necessities of adequate shelter are not adequate for the American people. And that's why when you go all over the country, what you see is the disrepair of America, as well as incredible poverty. We're getting short-ended on the necessities, and that's what really counts.
Consumer advocate Ralph Nader. So what should the corporate tax rate be? We put that question to economist Steve Slavinsky of the Conservative Goldwater Institute.
Well, I mean, I think we need to get back to where the OECD countries are and kind of in the low to mid-20s. And again, we need to be looking at how we're broadening the base in that respect. The goal would be to try to make sure that, in a sense, you're not taxing saving and investing as heavily as you're taxing something like consumption, for instance.
Well, Steve, when we hear people talk about broadening the base, isn't that code for asking poor people to pay more?
Well, it depends on what you're talking about. I don't necessarily think it's code. I think it is a realization that you're going to have some kind of tax shifting. I think what I'm talking about in terms of the corporate income tax and thinking of it in terms of how should we be treating the kind of good behavior we want to encourage, the idea that if you're working more and you're investing more, you shouldn't be penalized with a higher rate just because you've done more of that. And that's sort of what the current system does tend to encourage.
If the federal government were to lower corporate tax rates, let's say to what you're talking about, 20%, do you think ultimately it would actually generate more revenue?
Well, that depends on how much tax sheltering is going on right now. But I do think that you could probably see some kind of capital coming back into the U.S. And I think you would also see some kind of general increase in economic growth, which could also have a beneficial effect on tax revenues on other non-corporate types of revenue sources.
Now remember, earlier, reporter Jesse Drucker pointed out that American corporations aren't shifting money to places where the corporate tax rate is 10% lower than it is here in the U.S. They're moving it to places where the rate is zero. So why don't we drop the rate to zero? Well, Republican presidential frontrunner Rick Perry is suggesting that in some cases, we should.
Corporate profits that are offshore.
About a month ago, at a small gathering in New Hampshire, he called for a tax holiday, a deal where American corporations could bring back the profits they keep in tax shelters overseas and pay something much, much lower in tax.
Say something like, if it's clearly going for job creation, like zero.
Zero. Now, Jesse Drucker says this is not a new idea. Back in 2005, a deal was indeed struck, a tax holiday, where the largest American corporations were allowed to bring profits back to the U.S. and pay just 5% tax on that money.
All of the independent research on that holiday shows the majority of the cash that was brought back from overseas was used to buy back stock and give companies a boost in their stock price. It wasn't used to hire people. It wasn't used to build new factories. And the notion that things are happening in the economy, that there are problems in the economy because U.S. companies don't have enough cash, is on its face wrong. I mean, the most recent data from the Federal Reserve shows that U.S. companies are sitting on a record pile of cash, nearly $2 trillion. So it's unclear why giving a tax break on earnings that have been moved overseas would do something to give the economy a boost.
Now let's talk about who gets the value of a project in Mississippi. The port of Gulfport was ravaged by Hurricane Katrina 6 years ago. The state has put about $500 million toward the restoration of that port, calling it a critical resource. But as NPR's Kathy Lohr reports, some local residents fear they won't see the benefits.
The port of Gulfport sits just off Highway 90, a main road that runs all along the coast. Katrina's 30-foot storm surge nearly destroyed this facility, which is the size of about 50 city blocks.
It was actually 100% useless that day.
Don Ellie is the port's executive director.
There was debris in the channel. You can't bring a ship in if there's debris or anything to compromise the safety of the vessel. A lot of our docks, 7 of the 10, they just weren't safe to use.
The restoration will increase the size of the port by about 50%, deepen the channel, and raise the port's elevation. We can't get too close to the construction, but drive nearby with Ali, who says the project will create a bigger economic engine here, especially as the region vies for business related to the expansion of the Panama Canal.
I think the port is not only vital to the immediate 20, 30 blocks that surround us, it is vital to the region.
The port expansion includes a new access road intended to move truck traffic from the coastal highway to Interstate 10, but the road goes right through a number of working-class neighborhoods, including Villa del Rey. Anthony and Eunice Crane's brick home backs up to what will be a new thoroughfare. They've seen several blocks of homes bought up and demolished to make way for the road.
I understand that's your moneymaker, but, you know, we live here. They don't live here.
There's a picnic table in the yard just off the back deck, and Eunice Crane says it's where their 6 children and 7 grandkids get together.
It changed the lives because we probably can't hear each other talk.
Then you think about the exhaust and all that stuff coming through here.
From the big truck, the diesel smell and all that stuff, you know.
The debate in Gulfport is not unlike the controversy surrounding the construction of interstate highways decades ago, which pitted established neighborhoods against economic expansion. But since Katrina, neighbors, activists, and pastors are coming together to question plans that really weren't examined before.
And I would like to say welcome to our first COAG structure and planning sessions.
Pastor Anthony Thompson is part of the Coalition of African American Communities. The group held its first meetings this summer. He knows they can't stop the port road, which was planned well before Katrina hit.
We don't want to just complain about the road and why we don't want it here, but we also want to present a plan or something that we think will work.
Thompson says the communities affected the most should see some real benefits.
So what we're looking to do is create a mixture of self-owned businesses and maybe some franchises, stores that fit what other people in this community are looking for.
The pastor is among those who have questioned more than $500 million in federal recovery funds being used to help rebuild the port. In 2008, civil rights groups sued to get the state to spend more money to rebuild low-income housing. A settlement was reached, but Mississippi Governor Haley Barbour says the recovery funds were always for more than just housing.
The money was for much more than just housing. The money was to try to bring back the Mississippi Gulf Coast bigger and better than ever. The fact that it coincided with the expansion of the Panama Canal made it the most promising economic development project that we could do to help the coast come back.
All along the Mississippi Gulf, housing activists say thousands of homes damaged by Katrina still need to be repaired. But everyone here also knows they need good-paying jobs in order to get people to remain on the coast.
Sometimes you have to make sacrifices.
Donald Evans is with the International Longshoremen's Association in Gulfport. His office will be bulldozed to make way for the new port road, and that's a hassle. But Evans says just 20% of his union members are back to work since Katrina, so he says the port expansion will be a big help.
Like I say, you know, it's not a whole lot of jobs in Gulfport, especially Mississippi, that pay $30 an hour, you know, for unskilled and basically uneducated labor.
2,000 jobs are tied directly or indirectly to the Port of Gulfport now, and state officials say that number will double when the expansion is finished in about 5 years. But some question the estimates and whether those who live here will actually get the jobs. Kathy Lohr, NPR News.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Alyssa Block. President Obama traveled to Richmond, Virginia today to promote his new jobs plan. He says the $447 billion package of tax cuts and spending would immediately lift the sagging economy.
It will create more jobs for construction workers, more jobs for teachers, more jobs for veterans, more jobs for young people.
President Obama is not alone in offering a jobs plan. Two of his Republican challengers for the White House recently released their own proposals, Mitt Romney and John Huntsman. And to compare these economic blueprints, we're joined now by NPR's Scott Horsley. And first, Scott, easy enough to say the president and his GOP rivals don't see the problem the same way.
No, they offer very different diagnoses of what's wrong with the economy, so not surprisingly, they have very different prescriptions for how to fix it. For President Obama, the basic short-run problem is just a lack of demand. You know, since the collapse of the housing bubble, consumers aren't buying like they used to, so businesses aren't hiring. That makes consumers nervous, and you get into this downward spiral. The classic Keynesian remedy for that is for the government to step into the void and prime the pump so you get more demand, more hiring, and try to reverse the cycle. And that's why last night, before that joint session of Congress, Mr. Obama proposed more than $100 billion in new public works projects for, that's government spending, and those payroll tax cuts to put more money in workers' pockets. Let's take a listen.
It will provide a jolt to an economy that has stalled and give companies confidence that if they invest and if they hire, there will be customers for their products and services. You should pass this jobs plan right away.
Well, that's the president's diagnosis and prescription. What do the Republicans see as the problem with the economy?
Well, Republicans say businesses would be hiring right now if they weren't weighed down by the fear of future taxes and government red tape. Here's Mitt Romney, the former governor of Massachusetts, rolling out his jobs plan in Nevada earlier this week.
If I'm in the White House, the first thing I'm going to do on day one is say all those regulations that were put in place by President Obama. And by the way, his rate of adding regulations is about four times greater than President Bush's was. So all those policies, all those regulations he put in place, I'm going to stop in their tracks.
I should note, Robert, we checked that figure with the Romney camp today, and they said the governor misspoke. The actual pace of regulations is only double what it was in the Bush years, and they based that on a study by the Conservative Heritage Foundation. But this is something you hear a lot from Republicans, both in Congress and on the presidential trail, that excessive government is the problem. You know, in Texas Governor Rick Perry's book, Fed Up, he offers a scathing critique of the New Deal and writes that the Great Depression ended with World War II only when, quote, FDR was finally persuaded to unleash private enterprise. That's a curious reading of history to suggest that World War II was somehow driven by private enterprise. During the war years, federal spending topped 40% of the total U.S. economy, dwarfing anything we see these days. But this is kind of the guiding principle of Republican economic policy these days, that the best thing for government to do is to simply get out of the way.
Now, of course, another big area where the Republican candidates would like to see less government is they'd like to see lower taxes.
That's right. Tax reform is a big part of both Mitt Romney's proposal and former Utah Governor John Huntsman's plan. Here's Huntsman in New Hampshire last week.
Rather than tinker around the edges of what is a broken system, I'm going to drop a plan on the front steps of the Capitol that says we need to clean house, get rid of all tax expenditures, all loopholes, all deductions, all subsidies, all corporate welfare. Use that to lower rates across the board and do it in a revenue-neutral fashion.
Now, pretty much everybody agrees that we need to simplify the tax code. President Obama will probably propose something similar when he unveils his tax plan the week after next. When Huntsman says he wants it to be revenue-neutral, though, that means he's not counting on any additional tax revenue to help bring down the deficit. That's a distinction President Obama is. Now, Huntsman also wants to eliminate the tax on dividends and capital gains to encourage investment. That'd be a big windfall for wealthy Americans. Romney also wants to eliminate those investment taxes, but only for middle-class taxpayers.
Now, are there any areas where the Republicans and the president actually agree?
There are. All of them stress the need to boost exports and promote free trade, although Republicans say Mr. Obama hasn't moved fast enough in that area. And they all stress the importance of a more educated workforce as the global economy gets more and more competitive. Mr. Obama told students in Richmond today, "I know you're having fun here at the university, but you've got to hit the books."
Thanks, Scott.
My pleasure, Robert.
That's NPR's Scott Horsley speaking with us from the White House.